Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Yeah. I think there's always something especially fun in being a long way away from home, but being with people who you know see the world the same way. And I've just been particularly eager to come here after introducing myself to the Bristol Radical History Group website and being just amazed and envious at the array of activities you seem to have going on here. I really don't know of any equivalent in the U.S. It's also a real honor to be here together with so distinguished a troublemaker as Richard Hart, not only for his political history, but because I learned so much from his writing in the course of researching my own book. Well, this year, as you certainly know by now, is the bicentenary of the abolition of the British slave trade. And, you know, I think centenaries and bicentenaries are something one should always be a little suspicious of, because there's always an element of self-congratulation to them. And especially when they're staged or encouraged by governments, you can be pretty sure that there's some sort of politically self-congratulatory motive behind it. But what's interesting to me about what's going on in the UK so far this year is how contested this bicentenary is. Because of having recently written a book on the subject, I seem to have gotten on the list to be notified of events of various kinds that are being staged to mark it. And when in the same week I heard about commemorative events being staged by the House of Lords and the Socialist Workers' Party, then I knew that this is a contested piece of history. So what I want to look at tonight is just some elements of that contest. What I thought I would do is first use some images to take you through the traditional view of the history, the mythologized view of the history of British slavery, abolition of the slave trade, and emancipation, and then talk about one of the stories that it completely obscures, one of the stories told in the traditional way. So let's begin with the image that is on the screen here. This is Britannia in 1807 proclaiming to the world the good news of the abolition of the slave trade. A few quick images just to remind us of what the British slave trade was.
Whoa. Hierarchies. The arrow, I'm pushing the arrow. Oh, these arrows. Sorry.
Okay. As you know, the slave trade began in the interior of Africa as convoys of slaves were marched to the coast, and there they were often kept in the dungeons of the great slave fortresses, like this one at Cape Coast Castle, Ghana. And it was from these dungeons that they were then loaded onto ships, such as this one, which sailed out of the port of Liverpool, and taken to the Americas. In the second half of the 18th century, Britain dominated the Atlantic slave trade. Ships like this one carried half of the enslaved Africans taken to the New World, which meant British ships were carrying about 40,000 slaves a year. And they were delivering them, of course, not just to British colonies, but to other countries' colonies in the West Indies and to the American South. This is a poster, for example, advertising a slave sale from a British ship that arrived in South Carolina in 1760. We know from shipping records that 40 slaves died on this voyage. Okay, here is Britain dominating the Atlantic slave trade. Why did the British part of the slave trade come to an end? Well, the way the story has been traditionally told for the better part of two centuries, it came to an end largely due to the work of one man who has been very much put on a pedestal. Sometimes it's a literal pedestal, which is more than 100 feet high in his hometown of Hull, and I don't need to tell you who's at the top. It's William Wilberforce. As you probably know, he was elected to Parliament as a young man in the early 1780s, the age of 21, and then encouraged by his friend, Prime Minister William Pitt the Younger, further encouraged by his spiritual advisor, Reverend John Newton, he then took up the issue of the slave trade and ceaselessly spoke about it in the House of Commons for many, many years, until in 1807, in the traditional telling of the story, largely because they were swayed by his eloquence and that of his friends and supporters, the House of Commons voted to abolish the British slave trade. Now, Wilberforce was just as much celebrated in his own lifetime as today. This is a commemorative medallion in his honor that was struck in 1807. And when the British slave trade was abolished that year, there were many, many images like this one that appeared. It's a little hard to read the type on the screen. What it says at the bottom is, "To the ardent friend of the human race, William Wilberforce, Esquire." Note that the slave is, of course, gratefully kneeling, looking up thankfully, not, heaven forbid, on his feet, rebelling, running away, anything like that. The type surrounding the picture reads, "Africa exulting, echoes in responsive acclamation, and the fettered slave shakes his chains with joy." Now, although the ending of the British slave trade was undoubtedly a good thing, it is, of course, rather hard to imagine slaves shaking their chains with joy at this point, because in 1807 they were, of course, still enslaved, and as far as they knew, this was a condition that was going to last for a long time, which it did. So then, in the traditional telling of the story, Wilberforce then turned his attention and that of his friends to British slavery itself, and supported by members of the Clapham sect of evangelicals, people who worshipped at this church on Clapham Common in London, he then began to speak out in the House of Commons against slavery itself. And finally, in 1833, a few years after his retirement from Parliament, both houses of Parliament voted to emancipate the slaves of the British Empire. This was always portrayed as being greeted with a tremendous enthusiasm in the West Indies. This particular image was one that was reproduced widely, of this rejoicing former slave. Here it is on a medal. Again, a little hard to read, but the type around the edge reads, "England I revere, God I adore, now I am free." There were many paintings that appeared at the time like this one, which shows Wilberforce being thanked by grateful slaves in a field. Again, a little fanciful because, through no fault of his own, Wilberforce never went to the West Indies, and I'm sure never in his life even met a slave. He is remembered in many other ways. This is his statue in Westminster Abbey, another statue of him in Hull. There have been, by my count, close to 36 biographies of Wilberforce published, all of them with titles like this one, Statesman and Saint. Here are a few other Wilberforce biography titles. The Man Who Freed the Slaves, God's Politician, He Freed Britain's Slaves, The Freedom Fighter, so on. Now, lest you think that the traditional telling of this story is something that belongs only to the past and only to school books that were used a long time ago and so forth, on the 25th of this month, there is being released a new feature film directed by Michael Apted, starring Albert Finney and all sorts of other people, which once again tells the entire story centered around William Wilberforce. Here's a scene from the film, which is open in the U.S. I've seen it there. And here is a scene from the film, something that never happened in real life, Wilberforce standing on the deck of a slave ship, displaying chains and shackles and so on to shocked members of Parliament. Here's another scene, which certainly never happened this way in real life, which shows him unrolling a big petition against the slave trade
in the House of Commons and saying to his fellow parliamentarians, you must listen to the voice of the people, which we can be quite sure that Wilberforce never said anything remotely like that because he was opposed to extending the franchise. This at a time when only 5% of the British population, all men, could vote. So this is the traditional telling of the story. In some sense, all of it is true. Wilberforce did lead the opposition to the slave trade in Parliament and then for some years to slavery itself. But telling the story this way greatly obscures and underemphasizes another story, which is, how did those signatures get on that petition? Wilberforce certainly did not go around and gather them himself. The story that's really obscured here is one of an enormous and very unexpected widespread popular movement in Britain. Now, because as we all know, all too well, then and now, parliaments and legislatures, whether it's the British Parliament or the American Congress or anything else, they only act about anything when people light a fire under them. So the story that has largely been obscured is how that fire was lit. Now, there are a number of points that we can begin the story, but one of them is Cambridge University, 1785. The Vice Chancellor of Cambridge that year was one of the very few people in England who openly expressed any qualms about slavery. And he decided to try to bring some public attention to the issue by deploying the most powerful tool that a British University Chancellor, Vice Chancellor that day had. Namely, he made the morality of slavery the subject of the annual Cambridge University Latin Essay Contest. Now, winning one of the Latin Essay or Poetry Contests at Oxford or Cambridge was a huge deal in those days. For example, at this time in England, everybody knew that the then Lord Chief Justice, Lord Mansfield, half a century earlier, while a student at Oxford, had won the Oxford Latin Poetry Contest, beating out his lifelong rival, the elder William Pitt, who made a fatal spelling error. So winning one of these Latin prizes was an honor that stuck with you for the rest of your life. One of the people who entered that contest at Cambridge was a 25-year-old divinity student named Thomas Clarkson, somebody who had no previous interest in slavery or the slave trade or whatever. He just wanted the prestige of winning that prize. But he was a very, very hard-working researcher, a natural investigative reporter, read everything he could find about slavery, went out and interviewed people, talked to his own brother, who'd been a British naval officer in the West Indies and had seen slavery firsthand. A friend of his family's had been in the slave trade. The man had died recently. Clarkson got access to his papers and went through them. And he was shocked and horrified at what he discovered. And he writes very movingly about this in his autobiographical history of the movement, about how he left a candle burning in his room all night long in case some thought would occur to him that would be useful in writing this essay. He learned the conditions in which slaves were kept in the ships crossing the Atlantic. He learned that when they got to the British West Indies, most of them were put to work cutting sugarcane, then, as now, one of the hardest forms of manual labor on earth. He learned that slaves not working in the field were working in the sugarcane boiling houses in intense heat in the tropics, and that these boiling houses ran all night long in the harvest season, and slaves had to work 3 or 4 hours every other night in addition to 12-hour shifts in the field. These were some of the things that Clarkson wrote about in his Latin essay in Cambridge. He won the prize, read his essay aloud in Latin in this building at Cambridge where such ceremonies are still held today, and then he got on the horse that he owned and set off for London to make his way in the world. Halfway there, he reached a point where the road crossed the River Lee which unfortunately no longer quite looks like this today, and found himself thinking not about the honor of having won this big Latin prize, not about the promising career that awaited him, but about slavery. And he wrote years later, "I sat down by the roadside and held my horse, and here a thought came into my mind that it was time some person should see these calamities to their end. Got back on the horse and spent the remaining 61 years of his life working first to end the slave trade and then slavery, first in the British Empire, then in the rest of the world. A couple of years ago when I was working on my book, my wife and I went to try to find the spot where Clarkson had gotten off the horse, because somebody put up a small stone obelisk there in the 19th century. And we found it. Now, unfortunately, it's not a picturesque horse path, but a very busy highway. And as we were examining this, there was a man up a telephone pole working on the telephone line who sort of came down to try to figure out what was this American couple doing at the roadside. And we explained, and to my great delight, he knew who Thomas Clarkson was. Clarkson continued on that journey to London, translated his Latin essay into English, published it, and Wilberforce later said that reading Clarkson's essay was one of the things which first made him aware of what slavery was. Clarkson then spent many months going around London trying to meet up with anybody who could join with him in a movement to bring this evil to an end. He got to know a man named Granville Sharp, a wonderful 18th century radical, all-around eccentric, self-taught lawyer, musician, pamphleteer on a great variety of subjects, who believed in all sorts of things which were considered extraordinary at the time, such as popular election of bishops, popular election of generals by the soldiers serving under them, something which would be looked on with great horror today, still, I'm sure, and many other things. For 20 years, Granville Sharp had been working. He had a reputation as being somebody that slaves in trouble in London could go to for help. And he had fought a series of legal actions, some of which he won, on behalf of slaves who were being sent back to the West Indies against their will by their masters. Clarkson also spent a lot of time with Quakers, because he soon learned that the Quakers were the only religious denomination in Britain at the time, which had taken a principled stand against slavery. The Quakers knew something about oppression themselves, many of them having suffered imprisonment at the end of the 17th century. Finally, May 22, 1787, Clarkson brought together a group of 12 people at the London Quaker bookstore and printing shop in a little courtyard called George Yard, which is still there today, a few minutes' walk from the Bank Underground station. And they formed themselves into a committee working to end the slave trade in the British Empire. I should stop and explain, as I'm sure many of you know, that the abolitionists first set their sights on the slave trade rather than slavery itself, because for two reasons. One was that both they and the plantation owners were convinced that if the slave trade were cut off, British slavery itself would wither away and die. Why? Because the death rate on the Caribbean plantations was so high that the slave population would have been dropping by 2 to 4% a year if it were not for the constant new supply of slaves from Africa. The other reason they targeted the slave trade first was they felt they had a realistic chance of getting this through Parliament, because Parliament had a long history of regulating trade, whereas ending slavery itself, they would consider Parliament would consider something more radical, because it involved taking property, human property, away from its owners. So they targeted the slave trade. Shortly after that, a couple of weeks after that first meeting, Clarkson got on his horse and set off on a 5-month organizing trip around the country. Keep in mind, this is 2 years before Wilberforce said a word about slavery in Parliament. What Clarkson was doing on this trip on behalf of the committee was everywhere he went, he distributed anti-slavery literature, and he set up local committees which would be in communication with the committee in London. His first stop was Bristol. And what he was doing here, in addition to setting up a local anti-slavery committee, was he was looking for witnesses. Because this was one of the major slave ports, he wanted to find people who had worked on slave ships, people who worked on West Indian slave plantations, but who had developed guilty consciences about it, who would be willing to speak out to come and testify before Parliament, because sooner or later Parliament would have to hold hearings on the subject. This was an extraordinarily gutsy thing to be doing, looking for hostile witnesses from people practicing the slave trade. It would be a little like today, going to Washington, D.C., going into the Pentagon, knocking on doors and saying, I'm looking for whistleblowers about the war in Iraq. You would get ejected very quickly. Nonetheless, Clarkson, after some weeks here, managed to find a number of people who later did come and testify before Parliament. After a month or two in Bristol, he moved on to Liverpool, which was then the world's largest slave ship port. That year, 1787, 69 ships left Liverpool for Africa to fill up with human beings and transport them to the Americas as slaves. At one point, when he was walking along the docks in Liverpool, a group of slave ship officers surrounded Clarkson and tried to kill him by throwing him off the end of a pier into the sea during a storm. He managed to escape, however, but not without being injured. Something else happened to Clarkson in Liverpool. He walked past the window of a ship chandler's shop, and this is what he saw in the window. Handcuffs at the top, leg shackles at the bottom, and the thumb screw, an instrument of torture, on the left-hand side, and that thing with the spikes on the right. He asked the shop owner what that was for, and the shop owner said, well, this is for when your slaves on shipboard are trying to commit suicide by not eating. This is what you use to pry their mouths open. Clarkson said, give me one of each. He put them in his saddlebags, and then from then on, wherever he went, he would use these as tools to show people what the slave trade meant in practice. He would take them out, put them on the desk of the local newspaper editor and say, this is what our British sailors are doing. You have to write about this. Over the next few years, the Abolition Committee in London developed the most extraordinary variety of tools to get their message across. They built this model of a slave ship specifically for showing to members of Parliament. A local committee that Clarkson set up in the town of Plymouth came up with this poster, which I'm sure is familiar to you because it's on the cover of half the books about slavery. It's in every TV documentary about the slave trade. This diagram is of a specific slave ship, the Brooks of Liverpool, and it's actually rather conservatively drawn, showing fewer slaves than we know that ship carried on certain of its voyages. As soon as the committee in London saw this, they realized what a powerful tool it was, printed up 8,000 copies, and put them up in pubs all over Britain. This was the world's first widely distributed political poster. Another thing they did was to get friends who were poets to write anti-slavery ballads, which were sung, set to music and sung, and they were sold on street corners for a halfpenny apiece. All means of getting the message across. Here's Clarkson, a little bit older. He estimated that over a 7 or 8 year period, he covered 35,000 miles by horseback all over England, Scotland, and Wales, journey after journey after journey, setting up new committees, distributing literature, gathering witnesses. There's another tool that he used during those journeys, which is shown at the bottom right-hand corner of the painting. And it's a box containing samples of cloth, wood, ivory, spices from Africa, all in order to show people Britain could trade with Africa in something other than human beings. Another tool that the movement developed was the consumer boycott. This sugar bowl says on it, East India sugar not made by slaves. What happened was that by early 1792, more than 300,000 people in this country were refusing to eat West Indian sugar. That was the principal product produced by British slaves. People were impatient that Parliament had still not yet banned the slave trade. They wanted to bring pressure. This was the first really widespread and well-organized consumer boycott, on that scale. Two other things are notable about it. One is that it was something that truly sprang up from the grassroots. Even though Thomas Clarkson himself was very much in favor of the boycott and enthusiastic about it, the Abolition Committee never officially endorsed it because Wilberforce was opposed. He was always very suspicious of anything that smacked of, you know, the popular will being expressed in an unfettered way. The other thing notable about the boycott was, of course, who were the people in every household who were making the decision about what food to buy or not buy? It was women. Women in Britain at that time could not vote, could not hold public office, had many fewer legal rights than men, and for tens, probably hundreds of thousands of women who took part in the sugar boycott, it was their first chance of political expression in any way. The most notable woman abolitionist came along a little bit later, Elizabeth Hayrick, a wonderful, fiery Quaker pamphleteer who inspired the formation of some 70 women's anti-slavery societies, or as they were called then, ladies' anti-slavery societies. It was, of course, unthinkable that women and men be in the same political organization together. Interestingly, these ladies' anti-slavery societies were almost always more radical than those of the men. Mm-hmm. Some people who also get left out of the traditional telling of the story are the black abolitionists. The best known of these, Olaudah Equiano, has been sort of rediscovered in recent decades, largely because of the remarkable autobiography he wrote, which I'm sure some of you are familiar with. He'd been a slave in the British West Indies, a slave of a Royal Navy officer. Then he earned his freedom, earned enough money by trading on the side to buy himself from his owner, made his way to England, spent the latter part of his life here. In 1789, he wrote his autobiography, a book which is even more widely read today than it was in his lifetime, and he spent 5 years traveling throughout the British Isles talking about his book, which meant that for tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of people, he was the first black person they'd ever seen, and he was the first chance that people had to see slavery through the eyes of somebody who'd actually experienced it. And I think for a political campaign to reach the public, you know, having somebody like that who could be an eyewitness is a tremendously important thing. Another black abolitionist, we think this picture is of him, but we don't know for sure because there's no absolutely certain identification, was Otobu Kuguano, who was a friend of Equiano's, who also published a book around this time, 1787, described his own life experience. He had been a... lights just came on. Oh, there we go. Okay. He had been taken into slavery from Cape Coast Castle in Ghana, that we just saw a picture of before, taken to the Americas, then made his way to England. His book is notable for another reason, which is that he's one of the very, very few writers I know of in the late 18th century who denounced colonialism. He did not quite go so far as to denounce British colonialism, but he denounced Spanish colonialism in the Americas and said that it was a crime to have taken land away from the Native Americans who lived there. So, with the help of people like this traveling around the country, with the tremendous sense of popular revulsion against the slave trade expressed by things like the sugar boycott, this became a very powerful movement. There were huge mass meetings. Something else that gets obscured in the traditional telling of the story, where all the emphasis is put on Wilberforce and the Clapham sect, the very upper-class aristocratic group of people, is that this was, in quite a remarkable way, a movement which crossed class boundaries in Britain. For example, in Sheffield, which then as now was famous for making scissors, razors, knives, that kind of thing, swords in that day as well, in 1789, 769 Sheffield metal workers signed a petition to Parliament against the slave trade, saying, and I'm translating from the very ornate 18th century language, you know, you might expect us to be in favor of the slave trade because a lot of the goods we make are sold to slave ship captains and used in trading for slaves in Africa, but we want to express our feelings for our African brethren. So this then is the movement that lay behind those signatures on the petitions to Parliament. In 1792, 390,000 people in Britain signed petitions against the slave trade to Parliament, which was more people than were eligible to vote in this country at that time. And I think, to me, what is so remarkable about the movement here was that it was really the first time anywhere that a large number of people in one country became outraged and stayed outraged for many years over the plight of other people of another color in another part of the world. That had not happened before. Sometimes when that fact is acknowledged in the traditional telling of the story, they use the word humanitarian. This was the first humanitarian movement. But I think, in the language of today, we can also think of it as the first solidarity movement, in the sense that, you know, the pressure against South Africa in the 1970s and 80s coming from the U.S. and Europe was really quite influential, I think, in bringing about the change there. And this movement was an ancestor of all kinds of movements like that. Okay, normally when I'm talking, I go on to talk about a second story that the traditional telling obscures, which is the story of the Caribbean slave rebellions, but one of the great experts in the world on this, Richard Hart, is here, so I'm going to leave that part of the story.